So migrants are a very particular bunch. There are very specific conditions that lie behind it. And if we're too generic, or they are from poor countries, they want to come to rich countries, then we should have 2 billion migrants.
Coming up on In Contrast, Saskia Sassen, Amilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Saskia Sassen is an internationally known commentator on global issues and a professor of sociology at Columbia University. Known for her analysis of globalization and human migration, Sassen is the author of A Sociology of Globalization and Cities in a World Economy. Saskia Sassen, it's a wonderful pleasure to have you here in Contrast. Thank you for coming.
And I'm delighted to be here.
I want to start with probably your central theme throughout your life, and that is the global city. The city that has changed over time, that mutates, that has multiple layers. The city that has survived from the past and that is looking into the future. But your attention goes to what you describe as the global city, meaning those cities like New York, like Tokyo, like London, that are undergoing an even larger change and that are erasing aspects that are local and are connecting people to their own foundation, to the roots, and pushing the sense of the international or the planetary to the degree that one no longer knows what is in Tokyo or what is in London or what is in New York and so on. Where do we start with a definition? What does it mean global for you?
Well, I am trying to, number one, differentiate global from international. We have had international modes for a very long time. And a lot of what we now just think easily is the global is actually more of that international. In the international world, the particularity of a country, of a government, of a culture stands out. And often it is a reaching out to another country. When the global enters the picture, one image that I have, and it's sort of an urban image, is that sort of a complex space shift with all kinds of capabilities and forms of knowledge actually descends and installs itself in a whole set of cities. The global city only functions if there are multiple global cities. So it's a bit different from the more traditional international transactions. It is like something that comes a bit from outside the city, but needs urban space. Why? Because that is where you find an extraordinary mix of knowledges and of needs, and hence business.
You don't describe yourself, or you acknowledge not to be an urbanist. You, in contrast, are fascinated by systems, the city as a system or a coming together of multiple systems.
I really appreciate that you notice that. Because when I get questions about all kinds of features, say, of cities in the Midwest, that is not my forte. That is not my strength. I do think of the city, especially major cities, as complex but incomplete systems. So that then leads me to a kind of inquiry, a kind of research that is not simply describing the wonderful features of a city. You know, it's like a digging expedition. The surface experience is not enough to capture something that keeps those cities alive. And let's remember that many of these cities have existed for hundreds of years. They have outlived all kinds of far more powerful actors than the city itself, though they were in the city. So that in itself is also, what kind of a system is this that can outlive far more powerful actors? And in some parts of the world, I mean, they're 1,000 years old or more. That's quite, you stand back and you say, wow.
How did you arrive to this fascination, maybe even obsession with the city that you have? You are of Dutch ancestry or descent. You're a speaker of many languages, at least 5, though I've heard you say that you don't speak any of them perfectly, which is a feature of the global times in which we exist.
Right.
And are you at the same time connected with one city in your upbringing that you would say defined you, or it was the movement, the migration that was at the core of that fascination?
You know, in many ways you are right that it was the migration aspect. So I grew up in Buenos Aires, but when I was 16, we moved to Rome and my family was there 14 years. And then I left Rome. I couldn't stand Rome at some point. That was a long time ago. It was a different city from what it is now. And I came to New York. I came actually as an undocumented migrant with a tourist visa. It was a different time. And New York grabbed me, partly because it also had so many Latinos, because after all, I grew up in Spanish and in Dutch. And for the longest time, it was more the migration aspect and the mobility of capital that drove my work. My first book was on that, that the mobility of capital was never put together with the mobility of migrants. And I decided to write a book where I put those two in conversation with each other, because the migrants often were originating from the fact that foreign enterprises had set up business in their countries. So they said, well, if I can work for them here, I can also work for them in the United States or in Germany or whatever. So there was a kind of a logic there that I thought went unnoticed. When you think of poverty as a cause of migration, we should have far more migrants than we have. So migrants are a very particular bunch. There are very specific conditions that lie behind it. And if we're too generic, oh, they are from poor countries, they want to come to rich countries, then we should have 2 billion migrants. We don't.
We, the world, are also at a time in which the topic of migration is incredibly explosive. Yes. Here in the United States, under the Trump administration, there seem to be no more
patience.
And at the same time, there is a distinction between migrants that come with a degree and with capital, the ones that you were mentioning, and migrants that come without degrees, sometimes without papers, and they are ready to do jobs that the average American middle class or working class might not be able to do. Du Bois once described the 20th century as a century that would be defined by the color line. It seems to me that the 21st century is one where migration, maybe mixed with the color line as well, is that line. How have we come to this point where migration is such a combustive issue?
Well, what you just said now is sort of interesting. You know that the migrant has been transformed as a subject. It's no longer our understanding from the late 1800s and the early 1900s, when the migrant was sort of almost a self-evident figure, because so many, of course, who had come, say, to this country, had come as migrants, inevitably. And I think today we have two vectors in place, I would say, that are overlooked too frequently. One is the fact that even if we look, say, through a satellite image, it looks like there is a lot of land, unoccupied land in Africa, in parts of Asia, in Latin America. Well, in fact, by now, it's a story that really begins after 2008, the financial crisis. Most of that land has been bought by about 150 corporations. That includes the Nestlés and the Coca-Colas, who just want land to grab water. It includes mining, but it also includes plantation, agriculture. So we have a whole bunch of countries who are growing a lot of the food that they need in big pieces of land in diverse countries, in Brazil, in parts of Africa, etc., etc. And that is sort of invisible to the eye. So we, if we take a satellite image, we think, oh my God, all this empty land. Hell no, it's not empty. It's owned and it's being used. That has meant a kind of expulsion of the estimate is, these estimates are very difficult, they're not necessarily so reliable, but about 1 million people every year in the last 15 years or so have been pushed out. They're smallholders, small farmers, and they wind up in the big shanty towns around cities. And some of them, of course, become migrants eventually. So I'm always sort of amazed that we don't have more migrants. Today we can interpret that as the closing of openings that once existed. The migrants are no longer welcome. But already when the migrants were still welcome, when they were not such an issue, you saw that most people did not leave their countries. And I think that is a datum that often gets forgotten. I think in the West, in Europe, here, we tend to think, oh my God, it's the invasion. It's not. The question really is, why not many more? We have 2 billion people who could be migrants. And that is so far, you know, if we have like 300 million, not billions, who are migrants.
So why?
That's
why
right.
Aren't more people given the presence of corporations acquiring land rotated around resources like water, we are describing this as a global crisis. The fact that you have from Africa on boats going to Italy or going to Greece, or from Mexico in Central America to the United States, even within small countries like Haiti and the Dominican Republic, you have this move from the side of Haiti to the Dominican Republic, when in fact you also have the Dominican moving to the United States as immigrants themselves. Why don't we have more? Because of the attachment to land?
No, I think that the migrant is a person who somehow has made a connection. And in the case of Haiti, in the case of Dominican Republic and a few other countries, it's very clear that when we, for instance, occupied the Dominican Republic because the Dominican people had chosen a lefty president, what did we do? We invaded.
By way you talk about the United States.
The United States. So what does it mean to invade? To invade means that you have a whole bunch of people from another country who have all kinds of needs, from washing the laundry to getting the food. Well, guess what? They then, the local Dominicans, are the providers. They iron the sheets. They do the this and that. They feel connected. The same thing was happening in Asia, say in Philippines, in Taiwan, in some other countries, when you first had a whole bunch of women working on assembling electronic components. They were the ones that became migrants because they said, I know them. I know the foreigner. I can do this in their country too. They have a connection. I think one of the reasons that we don't have 2 billion migrants coming to the richer countries of the world is because they lack that connection. And they think that their future lies in their country, which I really respect. And I want to enable that. Of course, I am incapable of enabling that. But that is sort of my aspiration. But it also means this was the issue that I developed in that first book of mine, the mobility of labor and capital. I put labor first and then capital. That the migrant is the one who has had a connection of some sort with the other and feels I can do it. And out of that comes the strength. I mean, to be a migrant takes strength. You can't be weak. You cannot be a whiner who depends on this and that. No, you know you're on your own. And so that is what enables them, is that I know what I can do for them because I did it in my country. And this is a forgotten element in the discussion of the migrant.
So again, the migrant is part of a system, a network that enables those individuals to transition from one place to another and keep those connections that were already done in one way or another. In their original place.
Exactly. Now, there are always a few exceptions, etc., but that explains also a very important second point here is why we don't have more migrants. Because if poverty is the explanation for migrant or the search for a better life, we should really have 2 billion. And this is a question that never gets raised in the debate. Migrations often begin in the corporate headquarters of the receiving country. Now, sometimes it was explicitly that way, but I think the broader shadow effect, you know, has sort of the same quality, if you want.
And we don't talk about the migration, the higher level, which means that when a corporation in New York City or a corporation in London wants to open a particular headquarter in another city, there is a migration of labor within that corporation that will not have roots in London or in Milan or wherever it is, but that it functions as a kind of nation within the nation or state within the state and fluctuates, but with little regard to what is local.
That is now a major presence, I would say, right? All major cities in the world, there are about 70 global cities right now, right? Some more powerful, some more international than others. But they are really anchors for all kinds of foreign businesses and national businesses. And there is quite a bit of circulation. Many enterprises in country X love to hire somebody who has worked in country D, totally different country, in a certain kind of enterprise, because they come with knowledge. And if you consider the fact of the internationalizing or the globalizing of economic activity, then it really enables you to have somebody who understands something about the economy of that country, what is going up, what is going down, what not to bother with, etc., etc. The migrant is a carrier of a knowledge that the firm needs. It's not just what the migrant knows what to do. It is also where she comes from and what she can bring to the conversation. And so every time we, the West, has had operations abroad in another country, we have enabled a migration stream. The fact that the migration stream doesn't include all the poor and disadvantaged of that country is because the nexus is not there with all of them. It is with the people that they have used, often abused, etc., who create a community of possibility.
We were talking a little bit about water as a resource that draws all these shark-like entities that will buy land. I want you to reflect on the acquisition of space within the city, within the global city. You talk in your book, Expulsions, Brutality and Complexity in the Global Economy, and in talks that you give in interviews, about empty spaces within the global city, acquired by corporations or by foreign nationals that are literally empty buildings, sometimes empty in I have seen photographs that you use in some of your lectures that are in a state of decay, but they are acquired by, say, Russian oligarchs in London or by Chinese millionaires in New York. And the acquisition of that space is not used for human purposes. It's used as an asset.
Yeah, well, there are two steps here. So all that you said, correct? So it used to be that building a building or buying a building is a great way of cleansing dubious money. We know that. That's an old story. I mean, standing back and as a footnote, it's quite astounding how the real estate sector has managed to keep that going. Because in principle, they could have been, you know, subjected to some sort of control. So one thing then is that you buy a building as a way of cleansing money that is a bit dubious. There is now an emergent new way in which you can use that empty building. So rather than just being satisfied, okay, my money is now clean in this building and I can always sell the building. So now what has also happened is the repositioning of buildings that have value as something that allows you to generate a kind of financial instrument that you can keep buying and selling, buying and selling, buying and selling. The fact that it is empty makes it all so much easier than if you had the burden of the hassle of people in a building, for God's sake. And that is, of course, profoundly alarming. And so you see these empty towers, some fairly newly built. This is a minor proportion of all the buildings, but it's beginning to happen. That you say, oh, poor owners, look at that empty building. No, that building is actually delivering potentially quite a bit more than if it were just sold.
And it delivers in what form?
Well, these are complex asset-backed securities. The building, whether that is a toilet, a room, a roof, half of the building, whatever it might be, functions as asset. And that is via algorithmic mathematics. So with algorithmic mathematics, you transform the X. The X, we see it as building. But in the context of an algorithmic formula, it is no longer a building. It's a bunch of assets, you know, that you can buy, sell, and you can produce a lot of them or a few of them. So this is an extraordinary transformation.
Yeah.
And it's not visible. I mean, I'm very intrigued how in the urban setting, where you think that everything is a bit visible, you know, all those materialities, that there are these invisible functions that are enabled. This is brilliant stuff, and it's physicists who do that, clearly. You know, Goldman Sachs is full of physicists nowadays. And I don't blame them, because the physicists are just brilliant minds, and often by the time they are 30, they have done their best work, and so they wind up being employed in most financial firms nowadays are physicists. I mean, they have to. They just have to. So it's a whole new world that is a bit invisible.
Talking about invisibility, and invisibility really permeates many of the things that you've been talking about, because the immigrant herself can be invisible in the city in spite of her presence being quite obvious. You mentioned China not too long ago. The image that one has when traveling through China is of this, I would say, concrete-driven decades, this is the 90s in particular, where there was an urge or an urgency or an obsession to build at all costs. And here the metaphor is a fitting one. The amount of empty buildings that employed huge amounts of individuals, but that eventually were left as empty vessels, statements of the modernity that China had arrived to, but in spite of the overpopulation, not quite creating the nitty-gritty culture of individuals there. And it contrasts with a number of cities that when one travels through Africa or Latin America, where the buildings are decrepit, there has not been the investment to build more, and the contradiction is enormous.
Yeah. China has a model of development that is quite radical, subject to considerable controls, because the state is really the key actor, you know, in a way that we don't have in the West. And I think there are two elements that come in. One is what I just said, right, that it's sort of a we build, we clean. I mean, they're planting trees. They now have these Stefano Boeri types of buildings, where the buildings, there are trees on every floor, you know, the greening. They're way ahead in terms of the greening question. Beijing is a famous case for its, you know, bad air, etc., but because it's low level and behind it are all these mines. But when you look at Shanghai and you look at many of the other major cities, they have really succeeded quite well in cleaning up the air. So that's a major project for them, and they're gradually closing also the mines. So the Chinese have a capacity, and they have the resources, and they have the will, and they don't have a private sector that can grab a bit too much from all the good things, because this is what we have in the United States, I would say. There's a private sector that is a bit too grabby, and I say it kindly. I mean that in kindly language, but, you know, I could use more forceful language for it too. And so I am quite impressed with Beijing, and the data that I'm looking at, and I'm not alone with this, there are all kinds of people, the notion is that the center of power, of innovation, etc., is shifting towards Asia, but especially China and Singapore, certainly some of the surrounding countries, which are just extremely innovative. Singapore is amazing what it has done in terms of using technological tools and very advanced knowledge to address all kinds of issues that we simply cannot get done in this country, you know. So I think something has shifted. So it's not just China grabbing.
But has it also shifted in the sense that we're talking about centralized governments that have a controlling, even dictatorial approach, and that defy democracy? Democracy is a messy system where there are all sorts of voices competing with each other. Is the argument here that creativity can that can thrive where there is less of this cacophony that is taking place?
Well, that you mentioned, this is a critical point. I think the Chinese are still very much in the mode of controlling in ways that we would find unacceptable. There are, however, also emergent spaces, operational spaces, you know, spaces that are full of people doing something. It could be in the arts, it could be in the economics, which have a certain kind of autonomy. We tend to, in the West, to overdo the notion of China as controlling.
To simplify it.
Yeah. Now, what they're doing right now with some populations that they want out because they are not the proper or whatever, that's brutal, absolutely unacceptable. We in the West would see it as horrific acts of trying to change them. You know, there are many negatives. But the larger project of building up an economy, of addressing the environmental question, they have taken that seriously, much more seriously than the United States.
Or they have taken it seriously and can act, whereas we have taken it seriously and stumble all the time, again, because of the clumsy nature of how governments work in the West?
Okay, there is a bit of that. But I also think that besides the clumsiness, as you say, of a certain government system, I also think too many of our legislators are not doing their homework. They just don't care about understanding. We have a whole bunch of them who are fantastic, but there are too many who simply, they just go with it stream. Like, look what has happened under Trump, a willingness to sacrifice all kinds of environmental rules because Trump said, yeah, we have to do it this way and we want the money and whatever. So that is troublesome.
But isn't this always the political class can be lazy and self-interested and disengage with others and doesn't do its homework because it's better and more productive not to do its homework?
Exactly. No, there is certainly that. I think we have had better times. Mm. We have had where this country, because we are huge, we are enormously diverse, not just diverse in terms of people composition, but in terms of the different economies that we contain, right? I mean, it's just extraordinary. I don't know. This country is in many ways far too big to be one country. Yeah. You know, it should really be divided a bit into four. So it is complicated. The notion of the privatizing, you know, the whole move towards privatize, get the government out, I think that did not work the way it should have worked. Mm. And frankly, I thought at the time also that this cannot work if you give that much freedom. And furthermore, when you look at finance and very complex sectors, the government doesn't even try to understand, doesn't try to govern them because it's just too complex. And we have given a free hand, you know, to the financial sector.
I notice in the way you present your thought that you are pro a larger vision of government, in an all-knowing, maybe generous, philanthropic, and certainly a mutating and engaged government that helps all sorts of sectors find some sort of stasis or balance among each other.
That sounds very good. I like that. I also think that when you just take the few cases that we have, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, she knows a lot about one little part of finance, consumer finance. That's great. I think a legislature should have all kinds of people, also people who don't know anything about anything. That's also part of the story. Yeah. But we should change the rules a bit because we have entered an era where our economies are constituted in a multiple set of very complex sectors. And so we need expertise. She just does consumer finance. That's a very little part.
And certainly we live at a time when expertise in government seem to be at odds with each other. This, particularly with the Trump administration, calling someone who knows about a particular area doesn't seem to be the norm.
But this is a bit extreme. This is off the charts. So in the past, we have done a bit better with certain sectors where we've understood, okay, with the environmental question, we need knowledge. So we have given more respect to that branch in the government, though it's not part of the Congress. But we should do much more of that.
In this last portion of the conversation, I'd like you to reflect on your own intellectual journey. It seemed to me, and please correct me, that what you are still doing is some sort of sociology. At least I see you described as a sociologist, but sociology as implemented by you seems to be stealing or connecting with all sorts of different areas in the most interdisciplinary entrepreneurial spirit, a bit of urbanism, a bit of anthropology, a bit of finance, a bit of the political systems, a bit of chaos theory and all this. Is it still sociology or sociology kind of collapses? Do you still see yourself as the scholar that you were 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Do you know, I never was a straightforward sociologist, because I actually, at the University of Notre Dame, I launched a whole effort that I should also be able to be in economics. So I did that. I promised the dean that I would recruit students. I got one who dropped out after the first 2 months, but I followed it. So on my doctoral committee, for instance, I had two economists and two sociologists. So I have always navigated in a zone that I thought of as political economy. And that is, I think, how I see myself. When Stiglitz recruited me from the University of Chicago.
This is Joseph Stiglitz.
Yeah. I could choose my school. Where did I want to be at Columbia University? And I said sociology. Why? Because sociology allows me to do what I want to do. Sociology is fairly open. It either has a very sort of rigid format, which I'm not interested in, or it has a whole bunch of people who just do political economy, really. We are not a small number, you know. Political economists in sociology are very common. Now, I also happen to have studied quite a bit of economics. Maybe they all have not. So that is my comfort zone. And, you know, I never was troubled by the department that I'm in. When I get invited to a conference and then I see how they describe me, you never know, what are they going to say this time? And I'm fine with that. I just follow my nose, you know. I'm interested in discovery. And sociology, at some point, it's built a silo that is beginning to contain too little. Hmm. It's a little critique on a little deviation from a little piece that may have been founded on a big
because there's
concept.
There's the drive in our institutions of higher learning to turn us into specialists, knowing a lot about something that is minuscule. But you seem to be in reaction to this. You look at the broader.
I consider myself a specialist of a combination of elements. Mm. That simply means that I also need to know about the environment, that I also need to know about economics. I like economics. I don't mind it. There are certain forms of economics that would give me trouble. You know, I couldn't execute. But there is quite a bit that I understand because I studied it and I keep working on it. You know, I've been at it for, well, for several decades. Sociology is a comfort zone. And I think that there are sociologists in each major sociology department in the United States, for instance, who are also a bit transversal. something that is more difficult to do in other disciplines. Now, I am also noticing that departments of economics are now actively recruiting people who are more like me, because they understand that just an expert on the basic methods and the basic concepts is not enough to understand.
Is that in some way
economy.
Also a reaction to, or an extension of, a globalist approach to understanding things?
I think so, because once you enter the global economy, some of the very traditional narrow microeconomics just doesn't help you. It also doesn't help you when you enter other conceptions of what is a working economy, because that's the other thing that's happening. And the economy today includes a lot of novel elements and forms of knowledge that are different. When a firm goes international, it needs a lot of knowledge that does not necessarily come from economics.
And to conclude, you seem to, in the way you present your ideas, to be an advocate and a critic of globalism.
Yeah, I am. I am a critic of certain conditions that the globalization has brought with it. And I'm also a critic of how some experts talk about the global economy. I think they leave out too many things. So, no, I have very solid grounds for my critiques. Mm-hmm. It's not just, oh, wouldn't it be pretty? It's critiques that I have of certain modes of knowledge and what it gives us and what it fails to give us.
It's been a delight to have you here. Thank you for coming to In Contrast.
It was my pleasure.
The opposite of global isn't local. The opposite is anti-global. That's because the global and the local exist in a state of syncopated dialogue. We're always from somewhere. That somewhere is in dialogue with another somewhere. And in the global age, that somewhere is infiltrated, superimposed by many other somewheres. Ours is the age of anti-globalism. That's the message of populist leaders. Forget cosmopolitanism. Stick to your own business. It's a ridiculous position. Globalism isn't new. The Roman Empire was global. The Crusaders were global. Marco Polo was global too, and so was Columbus. The Enlightenment was a philosophy about the entire world, not about only Europe. Nowhere is globalism more tangible these days than in the big cities. New York, Tokyo, Frankfurt, Buenos Aires. Ads of transnational corporations are ubiquitous. So are tourists. You hear a plurality of languages. When you turn on the television in one of those cities, you see fashionable people that could be in any city. The local character is disappearing, yes. One constantly gets the sense that traveling to another city means little. Everything feels the same. You might as well have stayed home. But the global city really is more complex. It is about alienation. The local is marketed as a statement of difference. The homeless wander without a goal. Open your eyes and you see destitution, anxiety, suicide. Everything that glitters is not beautiful. You also see immigrants walking like ghosts, doing menial jobs that go unrecognized. The global city is about extremes, the ultra-rich and the rest of us. Those extremes hardly ever meet. Those who reject globalism are really blind. The right reaction to globalism needs to be altogether different. We need to humanize the cities. We have forgotten how to make them a home, how to feel secure in them. We have forgotten how to be happy. Happiness has become a casualty. We can be temporarily satisfied, but happiness is deeper. It is a more lasting feeling. The global citizen cannot be a robot. The global citizen needs to be grounded, needs to be local. It is preposterous to think that we can reverse time, that globalism can be erased. It is equally preposterous to surrender to the corporate approach to the global city. We are the citizens of those cities. We. Coming up on the next In Contrast.
Even if the global pie was increased, there were some people who were actually significantly hurt by globalization, and the failure was within the United States and within certain European countries. They didn't address those who were being hurt by globalization. And that has hurt the credibility of the advocates of globalization.
Joseph Stiglitz on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our intern is Delina Hadgu. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.